Welcome to EVR 2858. I am your professor, Professor Harwell. This is environmental law, and this is the introduction. We're also looking at environmental ethics, the commons, and the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe the three major human causes that account for almost all environmental degradation, the commons and the four possible arrangements to protect the resources of the commons, define the four steps of a risk assessment process as defined in this course, which section of the National Environmental Policy Act causes all litigation, and what that section's requirements are. Also, does this section apply to everyone? And the three threshold requirements of an environmental impact statement. Now, what we are looking at in this class is the major legislation relating to the environment. We're also looking at local, state, and federal laws in total. We're looking at habitat destruction, endangered species, environmental contamination and pollution, and to teach you how to find and understand the text of current legislation. Students who successfully complete the course will be expected to understand the legal issues involved in the status and conservation of Florida wildlife resources, flora and fauna, Florida's air resources, Florida's water resources, including surface water, groundwater, and stormwater, Florida's soil resources, and the manufacture, transport, sale, use, and disposal of pesticides as related to actual or potential environmental impact. Our assessment methods are bulletin board discussion participation. There are four writing assignments. There is a midterm exam and a final exam. In here, you'll find that all our materials for this course are included in the lecture, and I will give you links for websites outside of this material. Our module weeks start on Thursdays, and I have the list of our class lectures, also when each paper is due and when our midterms and exams are. The writing assignments are to develop research and critical thinking skills. There's no right or wrong opinion, but you just have to support your opinion. What I think doesn't matter, it's what you can argue to me. We are using APA 7th edition formatting, and I also give you here some legal citation formatting you need to know. With spelling, keep in mind, spell check is not your friend at all times. A site, S-I-T-E, refers to a lot or a physical area. You will be required to cite, C-I-T-E, to a reference. Some commonly misspelled words is judgment, it has only one E. Statute, make sure you have three T's, otherwise you're giving me Venus de Milo. And watch out for typing trail, T-R-A-I-L, instead of trial, T-R-I-A-L. And I do that one all the time. So let's look at how we get into courts. Well, for our science people in the audience, environmental law is what is known as administrative law. This means that it is codified by a legislative body. All right, the representatives we elect to the U.S. Congress or our state legislature sit down, come up with a plan about something. In this case, let's say it's clean water, clean air, something else. Using information they receive during hearings or from internal personal office research, language is crafted to tell the executive branch, i.e. the president or the governor, what to do. For instance, set up programs and encourage the creation of technology to require companies that dump wastewater to make sure the water dump doesn't contain high levels of chemical X. Codified means that these laws, these instructions, are printed in books known as the United States Code or the Florida State Code at the state level. There is a common law that is law which has evolved through judicial decisions. Some aspects of environmental law, such as standing, come from judicial interpretation. But for the most part, environmental law is set out by legislative bodies, Congress, and to a lesser extent, state legislatures, and there are strict parameters within which lawyers can work in. So how do you get through the courthouse door? Can anyone file a lawsuit? How do you file a lawsuit? Well, we've got to deal with legal hoops. With the law, there are various requirements that have to be met before you can file a lawsuit. We are mostly going to be talking about civil law, not criminal law. What's the difference? Criminal law is where the state sues a person for violating a statute, a law, or regulation, which was enacted to protect other people. Civil law is just about everything else from tort law, person A injures person B, corporate law, real estate law, environmental law, contract law, etc. Before you can get into the courtroom before a judge, certain requirements, hoops, have to be met, jump through. Technical legal requirements to getting through the door, this is what you pay a lawyer to deal with, are standing, reviewability, standard of review, and jurisdiction. So standing means you have the right to bring a case before the court, i.e., you have the right to stand before the court. This is a hot topic because most environmental laws allow what are termed citizen suits, meaning everyday citizens can bring suit to have the law enforced. There are those in Congress, business, industry, and the states that want to do away with citizen suits so that only governmental entities who enforce the laws can bring lawsuits to enforce those laws, instead of having to respond to citizens' demands that the laws be enforced. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, a plaintiff must show an injury in fact, and the plaintiff has an interest arguably within the zone of interest to be protected and regulated by the statute that the agency is claimed to have violated. It is called the data processing test. An example of an injury in fact can be seen in the following scenario. Pig farming is a huge business in the Carolinas and out in the Midwest. Pig farms usually have large pools of pig manure on the premises. Some environmental group sues, saying that the pig manure is emitting vapors causing air pollution, and the fecal pools are leaching into the aquifer causing water pollution. The court throws out the case. Why? Because the environmental group itself wasn't harmed. So the environmental group goes around to those people neighboring the pig farm and finds out these people are having breathing problems and have to purchase water at the store to drink and cook with because their tap water is tainted. The environmental group brings suit again, but this time the actual plaintiffs are the neighbors who are claiming harm has been done to them personally by the pig farms. By using local residents as the plaintiffs, the environmental group satisfies the requirement that there is the existence of a chain of causation between the allegedly illegal action of the pig farmers and an injury to some part of the environment used by the plaintiff. Next is reviewability. This is whether the issue is subject to a judicial resolution. Well, what does that mean? Basically, can the court review the question posed by the lawsuit? There is the standard of review. This is how the court addresses different issues in a case. Is it an issue of pure law? Is it an issue relating to the facts behind an agency's actions? Is it an issue relating to agency procedures? With questions of law, a court will give great deference to an agency because that agency was assigned the task of administering the law, with the caveat that the agency has had to have acted within the scope of authority delegated by the legislative branch. With questions of fact, the court can review the facts presented and determine if the agency's findings fit within the facts presented. As for agency procedures, courts give deferences to how agencies run themselves, but if the procedures do not make sense or are prejudicial against specific individuals, the court can invalidate those procedures. Now we have jurisdiction. There are two kinds, personal and subject matter. Personal jurisdiction is whether the person, i.e. the defendant, can be dragged into that particular court. It commonly relates to the physical location of the defendant. An example would be that I have an AT&T cell phone, and in the cell phone agreement, it states that if I want to sue AT&T, I have to sue in Kansas. I can file a lawsuit in West Palm Beach State Court, and the court will throw it out because I agreed to Kansas jurisdiction when I signed my cell phone contract. Why does this only matter with the defendant and not the plaintiff? The plaintiff submits to the court's jurisdiction automatically when they file the paperwork, called pleadings, with the court. The plaintiff says, I accept this particular court's oversight of my case. With a defendant, they have to be located within the area of the court. Now, there are cases where a person is served in the middle of the air on an airplane when they are crossing over state lines because they're trying to avoid that particular state, and yet they're in the airspace, so they're in the state, and they have been formally served and therefore can be dragged into the court. I kid you not. We have subject matter jurisdiction. This is whether the court can deal with the subject matter of the case, what the case is about, not the persons involved. This is like the reviewability question, but is different in that it is whether that particular court can review the case. For instance, if a person wants to file for bankruptcy, they must file in federal bankruptcy court, not state court. If you, living in Palm Beach County, want to sue a company in Broward County for breach of contract, you must file in the state court because federal court is only available for persons of differing jurisdictions, in this case, differing states, not counties. Now we have law versus equity. Remember our pig farm scenario understanding. Here's a nuance to that scenario. The plaintiffs want money for their medical bills and to clean up the water. They also want the states and the feds to enforce the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts because the plaintiffs feel the government has been sitting on the sidelines and not doing their job. This nuance brings up an internal division within the civil court because decisions at law and decisions in equity. What's the difference between law and equity, you ask? When a plaintiff files a suit at law, the plaintiff is seeking money damages. The plaintiffs want cash. You know, show me the money. When you file an equity, the plaintiff is asking for something other than money. For instance, when dealing with environmental laws, the plaintiff is usually asking for the law to be properly enforced against the defendant. You want the agency to do its job of enforcing the law. Now, as I mentioned, there's jumping through hoops. Lawyers have to be careful when filing lawsuits because there is a requirement that plaintiffs exhaust all options prior to filing a lawsuit. These are the hoops I mentioned earlier. This means that you need to follow the steps set out in the law to encourage the defendant to follow the law and to encourage the administrating agency to enforce the law. For example, if the law says that a plaintiff must file a complaint with the agency's field office, be denied, appeal to the agency's headquarters, and again be denied, before filing a lawsuit in court, if the plaintiff doesn't file a complaint or appeal the initial denial, the court will throw out the case. Now, if you're confused, don't panic. This is just an overview of some general legal concepts that you will hear used throughout this course relating to the various statutes and cases we will cover. If you have questions, ask. The only stupid question is the one you don't ask. Now, there are nuances of statutory law. Here's a hypothetical question. The law says if some chemical dumped illegally turns you red, blue, orange, or purple, you have recourse against the dumper. What if you turn green? You turn green, no recourse. Why, you ask? Because the law specifically set out what colors are covered. There is a nuance to this, as there is in just about everything about the law. Let's say that the law originally said people were covered if they turned red, blue, or orange. Someone turned purple and sued. The court looked at the law and the congressional record and found that there was nothing stating that other colors couldn't be included. So that judge allowed the person who turned purple to recover from the dumper. Now, Congress becomes aware of this case and amends the original law to include people who turn purple. And during their discussions about this amendment, some congressperson says that the law is not to limit to the colors stated, but to give examples of colors illegal dumping might turn people. The amended law doesn't say this, but it's in the congressional record. You turn green. Even though the law doesn't say that you are covered to recoup your losses and expenses, you can point to the congressional record regarding the amendment of the law and say to the court, the law does cover me because I turned green and Congress said so. Congress said during deliberations that the law didn't limit what colors you could turn, but only gave examples in the law. Policy versus law. Since I have brought up Congress, there is another nuance to keep in mind as we go through these laws. We are talking about what is set out in the United States Code, the Code of Federal Regulations, and court decisions. The United States Code contains all the statutes passed by Congress and signed into law by the President. The Code of Federal Regulations are created by agencies of the executive branch according to instructions set out in the statutes from Congress. And court decisions are, of course, from the courts. So what am I talking about when I say policy? Policy is political. Policy comes from the executive branch, and it is how the application and enforcement of these laws are approached. For instance, in 1980, the U.S. Congress passed the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, CERCLA, to clean up places that were contaminated by industry. When President Ronald Reagan came into the White House, he did not prioritize CERCLA cleanups and basically redirected a lot of the funding to some of his other priorities. That was his choice in setting a policy based on the law. When CERCLA came up for renewal, the Congress was not happy that the priorities they set out in CERCLA were not being executed by the executive branch. So, in the Supplemental Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA, of 1986, Congress specifically said the president shall do certain things, as opposed to the Environmental Protection Agency administrator. This forced Ronald Reagan to enforce CERCLA and start many cleanup operations. With each change in presidential administrations, there will be changes in the federal government's approach. Many of those changes will be changes in policy implementation of existing environmental laws. So the laws, we will cover a number of laws and how they are administered. For example, there is the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. The Environmental Protection Agency is charged with administering NEPA, but in reality, it is up to each individual federal agency to keep NEPA in mind whenever that agency is planning something that might impact the natural environment. We will cover the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, touch base on the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, FIFRA, TSCA, RCRA, CERCLA, and some others. Now, keep in mind, there will be a lot of concepts and acronyms thrown around throughout this course. I suggest each student prepare a list of these concepts and acronyms to have on hand so you don't get lost. I have one myself for fast reference. For instance, I keep forgetting that R in CERCLA stands for response. So I have the entire term CERCLA spelled out as the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. So let's jump in and start looking at environmental ethics and the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, I'm going to state up front that this ethics discussion is an overview. I do not expect you to take this discussion as gospel or the right way of thinking about environmental ethics. I do expect you to think about how environmental ethics are approached. Why are we looking at ethics and this scenario, the commons? Because this is how environmental law is approached in law school. I will give you an idea of how lawyers are trained to look at environmental laws and environmental problems. So what is considered environmental ethics? According to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, environmental ethics is the discipline in philosophy that studies the moral relationship of human beings and also the value and moral status of the environment and its non-human contents. Now, there are different ways to view the non-human contents. One point of view is to say that a non-human component has instrumental value to the human population, i.e. that non-human component is valuable because it serves some purpose to humans. For instance, a cow is valuable because humans can eat it, can use its horns as drinking vessels, can use its hide as clothing, etc. The instrumental view is also known as utilitarianism, because the non-human component can be utilized by humans for their own survival. A second point of view is that a non-human component is intrinsic value in and of itself, i.e., that the non-human component is valuable whether or not it is useful to humans. For instance, a butterfly has no value to humans except that it's pretty. Ignore the fact that it is a pollinator for the moment. The butterfly has no instrumental value, but it has intrinsic value and should be protected anyway because it is a creature of Earth. Modern environmentalists draw inspiration and momentum from two giants in the field, Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson. Aldo Leopold is considered the originator of wildlife ecology. In the late 1930s and 40s, he wrote a Sand County Almanac, first published in 1949. This book is considered a cornerstone of modern conservation science, policy, and ethics. And that's from the Aldo Leopold Foundation. A Sand County Almanac is a collection of essays about the natural world and how it works. It inspired readers to take action to ensure the future health of the land and water that sustains all life. Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. For the 50th anniversary of the book's publication, the New York Times said, "Silent Spring presents a view of nature compromised by synthetic pesticides, especially DDT. Once these pesticides enter the biosphere," Carson argued, "they not only killed bugs, but also made their way up the food chain to threaten bird and fish populations and could eventually sicken children." Much of the data and case studies that Carson drew from weren't new. The scientific community had known of these findings for some time, but Carson was the first to put them all together for the general public and to draw stark and far-reaching conclusions. Rachel Carson took on the chemical industry, and the industry did everything in its power to discredit her and her research. We all know now that the result was banning DDT for use as a pesticide in the United States. There are three major human causes that account for virtually all global environmental degradation: population, consumption, and pollution. Now, population is the leading cause of environmental degradation. The more people there are, the more food, shelter, clothing, needs of life are needed to support these people. Continuing population growth greatly impacts government planning for industry, social programs, economic opportunity, and technological advances to relieve the troubles of humanity and the Earth. Population growth increases poverty, hunger, homelessness, and reduced opportunities. The more people, the more competition for limited resources, the greater the increase in the underclass. This leads to the other two causes. Consumption flows directly from population growth because the more people there are, the more resources need to be consumed to keep those people alive. And resources are limited. So this moves people to form groups to gather and control resources to the detriment of others who also seek those resources for survival. This leads to conflicts and wars that can also be considered environmental problems themselves. Instead of focusing on reducing poverty, reducing hunger, reducing homelessness, and increasing opportunities, governments instead have to focus on coping with these problems and coming up with short-term solutions to keep the peace. There is no possibility to do long-term planning for ecological stability and fair distribution of resources to all. Pollution is the cause that gets the most focus. Trying to get people to reduce their consumption, especially in the United States, is a Sisyphean task. Promoting reduced population has never gone over well anywhere in the world. Look at the one-child policy from China and the massive backlash that it received from the general public, different religious groups, etc. So we focus on the smallest of the three causes. Not to say that there isn't a lot of pollution around the world, but in comparison to population increases and the increase in consumption that comes with that, pollution is the smallest of the three causes. We will continue with that focus because that is what this class is about. And it is far easier to study legal remedies for controlling pollution than for controlling population and market consumption patterns. Now, I've mentioned the comments. The first law of ecology is everything is connected to everything else. Barry Commoner, it's from 1971. Keeping this in mind, environmental law covers a multiplicity of problems. When law students are introduced to environmental law, they are given the problem of the commons. The commons deals with common resources, such as air, water, wild animals, etc. Eventually, the common resources become scarce because people will act in their own self-interest, using the resource until the resource runs out. The commons details how various strategies are formed to address problems of pollution and degradation of resources. So, what kind of arrangements should be made to protect the resources we have? There are four possible strategies. The first is private property. Jay owns land upon which there are deer. According to the law of property, Jay owns the deer because they live on his land. The rest of the community are trusting Jay to take care of the deer and provide the deer not only space to live, but enough space for grazing range. If Jay decides to build on the land, there is nothing anyone can do. There is the voluntary arrangement. Neighbors give up part of their parcels of land or give funds to purchase a parcel for the deer to live on. The problem with this scenario is that someone has to do the talking and organizing for this to work. Who is going to administer all this? Local government? Then there are two problems that crop up. One are the free riders, people who don't give any lands or funds and let others do everything to save the deer, and two, the holdout. The last person to be approached to donate asks for a huge ransom in order to do what is asked. If you would like a great example of the holdout types of person, I suggest you see the movie Waking Ned Divine. In my opinion, it is absolutely hilarious. You may disagree. Next, there are economic incentives. This is taxing people for their pollution. Every community has this type of setup. For instance, garbage collection. The problem here is, where do you set the limit to encourage good behavior and discourage bad behavior? For instance, in West Palm Beach, each household pays a flat fee, no matter how much garbage they produce. There is no incentive to produce less. More than two decades ago, when my husband lived in Ithaca, New York, each household paid for trash collection by the number of bags it put out for pickup each week. The household had to purchase tags for each trash bag from the local solid waste folks. Thus, the fewer bags used, the lower the trash costs. And last, there's the coercive incentive. This is done by statute. Some statutes permit Jay to build on his lands, and some prevent Jay from building. An example of this is 25 years ago, Jay's grandfather purchased a piece of beachfront property and planned on building his dream home, but never got around to it. He dies, and Jay gets the property. Jay starts the process of building, but finds out that the three-story grand house his grandfather envisioned can't be built today because the coastal control line has been moved and all Jay can build now is a one-room shack. The statutes impose limits. Another example is each hunter can only kill so many deer per hunter each hunting season. Where do we set the level of regulation in order to achieve the goal we have set? So let's take a look at risk assessment. Risk assessment and risk management drive the majority of decisions made by regulatory agencies. At its essence, risk assessment is trying to determine the extent of the problem and how severe the problem really is. Risk assessment is largely a scientific process, like lab rat tests. There is always uncertainty within this. Why do you think there will be uncertainty? Well, different people can read statistics and see problems from different angles, producing different assessments. Risk assessment is a four-step process. You have the hazard ID, the exposure assessment, the dose-response relationship, and the risk characterization. So the hazard ID is, what is it we're going to measure? With the Everglades pollution lawsuit in 1988, phosphorus was chosen as the currency of interest to determine the health of the system from a legal regulatory perspective. There are other things that could have been measured, such as nitrogen or spatial extent of cattail, but there are limits to the amount of effort that can be expended, and then those involved have to determine what is easiest, most useful to measure. Exposure assessment is deciding how people are exposed to the substance, like getting pesticides from apples. Try a Wikipedia search for demonicide, the nationwide ALR concern from the mid-80s. Yes, I will tell you repeatedly, never use Wikipedia, but this is a really fast, down and dirty review, so it's okay. The pesticide is on the skin of the apples, but what about how much pesticide is in the orchard if you go to pick apples? What about people who live near the orchards and their exposure during the pesticide spraying with wind dispersal possibilities? What about the workers who disperse the pesticides? Where do you draw the line? Another component to the apple scenario is, are the apples pre-washed? Is food grade wax applied to them prior to shipping? Does the kind of wax used trap more pesticides or not? How does the final consumer eat the apple? Straight from the store bin? Does the consumer wash the apple with water? Does the consumer scrub the apple with their hands underwater? Is the apple washed with soap, a vegetable scrubbing brush, and rubbed dry? All of these actions either increases waxing or decreases washing the total amount of pesticides that you will ingest upon eating the apple. Next is the dose-response relationship. How likely is it that I will get cancer from exposure to certain amounts of substances? There is the low-dose response. Lab studies usually involve giving more of a substance than a typical person will consume or be exposed to and extrapolate from there for what the lowest exposure dose should be. An example of this is Sweet 'n Low. This is the original non-sugar sweetener. Back in the 80s, the news splashed around about how Sweet 'n Low caused cancer in rats, and the general population started using sugar again and looking for another sugar alternative. Meanwhile, if you read the actual studies and did the extrapolations yourself, the reality was that you would have to be eating something like 100 packets a day for 30 years in order to develop cancer like the rats that were tested. We have risk characterization. There is an X percent chance I will get cancer. But keep in mind that there are assumptions made which could make a difference in the characterization. Take our Sweet 'n Low story. The general population went overboard, thinking that they were going to get cancer tomorrow if they used that little pink packet today. I remember being young and worrying about my grandmother because she always used Sweet 'n Low, and how my mom and my aunts tried to get her to stop using it. Then we found out how much Sweet 'n Low the rats were fed and how that translated in reality to true human consumption. We thought the risk of grandma getting cancer was like 90% by using two packets a day for a few months, while it was more like 7% of all people using 100 packets per day for 30 years had an increased possibility of developing cancer. Large difference in the risk characterization, wouldn't you say? Then there's risk management. This is dealing with the information gathered in the risk assessment, taking the data and doing something with it, like saying how likely it would be to get cancer from eating an apple a day for the rest of your life. Let's take a look at the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. In the 1960s, with the Flower Child Revolution, people tried to become more conscious of the environment around them. More people became concerned about the problem of the commons. Our common resources were being polluted, and there was nothing people could do to stop industry from their course of continuing pollution. This produced the introduction of the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. It was signed into law January 1, 1970, by President Richard Nixon. This law provokes varied and diverse reactions. NEPA is administered by the Council on Environmental Quality. So what about the EPA? Here is the deal. NEPA created the Council on Environmental Quality, the CEQ, within the Executive Office of the President. The CEQ is tasked with advising the President, gathering information about the quality of the environment, reviewing various federal programs and activities to make sure those programs and activities are fulfilling the goals of NEPA, developing and recommending national policies to improve environmental quality, conducting investigations and research on ecological systems and environmental quality, tracking changes in the natural environment and determine their causes, and reporting to the President at least once a year on the state of the environment. The CEQ was put into place to be an independent voice for science to the President and make sure the EPA and other federal agencies follow the requirements of NEPA. The current chairperson is Brenda Mallory. So NEPA Section 101. Let's take a look at Congress's intent with this law. Here is Section 101. Notice how this is all one sentence. Talk about awful grammar with run-on sentences, but what does it really say? NEPA Section 101, Subsection A. The Congress, recognizing the profound impact of man's activity on the interrelations of all components of the natural environment, particularly the profound influences of population growth, high-density urbanization, industrial expansion, resource exploitation, and new and expanding technological advances, and recognizing further the critical importance of restoring and maintaining environmental quality to the overall welfare and development of man, decides that this is the continuing policy of the federal government in cooperation with state and local governments and other concerned public and private organizations to use all practicable means and measures, including financial and technical assistance, in a manner calculated to foster and promote the general welfare, to create and maintain conditions under which man and nature can exist in productive harmony and fulfill the social, economic, and other requirements of present and future generations of Americans. Subsection B. In order to carry out the policy set forth in this chapter, it is the continuing responsibility of the federal government to use all practicable means consistent with other essential considerations of national policy to improve and coordinate federal plans, functions, programs, and resources to the end that the nation may fulfill the responsibilities of each generation as trustee of the environment for succeeding generations, assure for all Americans safe, healthful, productive, and aesthetically and culturally pleasing surroundings, attain the widest range of beneficial uses of the environment without degradation, risk to health or safety, or other undesirable and unintended consequences, preserve important historic, cultural, and natural aspects of our national heritage and maintain, wherever possible, an environment which supports diversity and variety of individual choice. Achieve a balance between population and resource use which will permit high standards of living and a wide sharing of life's amenities and enhance the quality of renewable resources and approach the maximum attainable recycling of depletable resources. Subsection C. The Congress recognizes that each person should enjoy a healthful environment and that each person has a responsibility to contribute to the preservation and enhancement of the environment. Now, let's look at Section 101 again, but this time I've highlighted some parts. So in Subsection A, it says that Congress is, you know, recognizing we have impact, particularly the profound influences of population growth, high-density urbanization, industrial expansion, resource exploitation, and new and expanding technological advances. That it's a continuing policy, and the federal government is to use all practicable means and measures. The word practical comes up in subsection B, and that they set out a number of parts here saying that we're trustees for succeeding generations, that all Americans have safe, healthful, productive, and aesthetically and culturally pleasing surroundings, the beneficial uses of the environment without degradation, that we're preserving historic, cultural, and natural aspects. There's a balance between population and resource use, enhance the use of renewable resources, and recycling depletable resources. Notice the use of the word practical. It is not what is possible, because anything's possible. It's just the probabilities that get you. It is not what is probable, because that changes with a variety of factors, such as economic health, political leanings, and technological limitations, to name a few. This says practicable. What can be done today with the economy we have, with the political scene as it currently is, with the current technology? Also notice in subsection A that it is a continuing policy. NEPA was not meant to be a one-shot deal. Now that you've gotten a flavor for statutory writing, I must point out one thing. This is all fluff. This is the preamble, the reasoning behind the actual law. Here is where politicians wax poetic about all the grand goals. They don't get down to the nitty-gritty until later sections. So what did Section 101 say in English? Congress recognizes human impacts on the environment from a variety of things. It is the continued policy of the U.S. to use all practicable means to live in harmony with nature. The U.S. is a trustee looking for safe, healthful, productive, and aesthetically and culturally pleasing surroundings. Beneficial use of the environment by humans without harming the environment. Balancing population growth with resource use. Preserving heritage and culture. And using renewable resources and recycled depletable resources. It literally boils down to just that. Now, NEPA Section 102. This section is the most litigated section of the National Environmental Policy Act. Congress authorizes and directs that to the fullest extent possible, the policies, regulations, and public laws of the United States shall be interpreted and administered in accordance with the policies set forth in this chapter, and all agencies of the federal government shall utilize a systemic interdisciplinary approach with which the integrated use of the natural and social sciences and the environmental design arts in planning and in decision making, which may have an impact on man's environment. Identify and develop methods and procedures in consultation with the Council on Environmental Quality, established by subchapter 11 of this chapter, which will ensure that presently unquantified environmental amenities and values may be given appropriate consideration in decision-making along with economic and technical considerations. Include in every recommendation or report on proposals for legislation and other major federal actions significantly affecting the quality of the human environment a detailed statement by the responsible official on the environmental impact of the proposed action, any adverse environmental effects which cannot be avoided should the proposal be implemented, alternatives to the proposed action, the relationship between local short-term uses of man's environment and the maintenance and enhancement of long-term productivity, and any irreversible and irretrievable commitments of resources which would be involved in the proposed action should it be implemented. Prior to making any detailed statement, the responsible federal official shall consult with and obtain the comments of any federal agency which has jurisdiction by law or special expertise with respect to any environmental impact involved. Copies of such statement and the comments and views of the appropriate federal, state, and local agencies which are authorized to develop and enforce environmental standards shall be made available to the President, the Council on Environmental Quality, and to the public as provided by Section 552 of Title V, and shall accompany the proposal through the existing agency review processes. Study, develop, and describe appropriate alternatives to recommended courses of action in any proposal which involves unresolved conflicts concerning alternative uses of available resources. recognize the worldwide and long-ranging character of environmental problems, and, where consistent with the foreign policy of the United States, lend appropriate support to initiatives, resolutions, and programs designed to maximize international cooperation in anticipating and preventing a decline in the quality of man's world environment. Make available to states, counties, municipalities, institutions, and individuals advice and information useful in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing the quality of the environment. Initiate and utilize ecological information in the planning and development of resource-oriented projects. So, what did Section 102 say in English? All federal agencies shall use natural and social sciences in integrated decision-making. Identify methods to determine importance of aspects of the environment that aren't easily quantifiable to be used in decision-making. Develop detailed statements for legislation, major federal action affecting human environment. This includes environmental impact, adverse environmental effects, alternatives, short-term human use balanced with maintenance of long-term productivity, identifying resources permanently lost, and any federal agency official wanting to do a project has to consult with the appropriate federal agency or agencies with jurisdiction, e.g. the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Environmental Protection Agency. Prepare adequate alternatives, provide information to all interested parties, and show using information in decision-making process. So, just to let you know, I will not be reading through every last section of the law that I give you throughout this whole course. You get to pause and read it yourself. So, what requirements were set out? Well, there are threshold requirements, and there are three, to trigger the need for an EIS. Is it a federal action? Is it a major action? Does the action have significant environmental impact? So the first threshold requirement is federal. A proposed action is considered federal if some federal agency has the power to control the action. For instance, before any of the comprehensive Everglades restoration project components could be constructed, Clean Water Act Section 404 permits had to be obtained from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So a federal agency has the power to control the action. Whether or not the 404 permit is issued determines whether or not that project can go forward. There is the small handle problem. When federal interest action occurs on a small part of a larger project, comes into play as to where to draw the line when dealing with government agency action. Does a Clean Water Act Section 404 permit involve the government enough to say it is a federal action? The second threshold requirement is it major? A major federal action is a federal action that requires substantial planning, time, resources, or expenditure. This comes from the National Resources Defense Council versus Grant decision. Notice in the definition above the use of the conjunction or. A major federal action can have substantial planning or substantial time, or substantial resources, or substantial expenditures. It can have all of those things, or just one. Then there is significant environmental impact. Commonly, when defining significant environmental impact, we limit the definition to significant degradation of the environment. But that doesn't encompass everything. When the federal government and the state of Florida entered into a settlement agreement for the Everglades cleanup, no environmental impact statement was done. But the original judge overseeing the case, Judge Hoover, saw it differently. At the time, Judge Hoover said that even though the agreement was to restore the Everglades, the proposals being set forth would still have a significant environmental impact, and therefore an EIS needed to be done. The Council on Environmental Quality regulations set out various factors to take into account when determining significant environmental impact. It's the impact on public health, the unique features of the geographic area, precedential effect of the action, and whether action is highly controversial. So why do we have environmental impact statements? Well, the purpose is spelled out in the Code of Federal Regulations as put forth by the CEQ. The primary purpose of an environmental impact statement is to serve as an action-forcing device to ensure that the policy and goals defined in the Act, National Environmental Policy Act, are infused into the ongoing programs and actions of the federal government. It shall provide full and fair discussion of significant environmental impacts and shall inform decision makers and the public of the reasonable alternatives which would avoid or minimize adverse impacts or enhance the quality of the human environment. Agencies shall focus on significant environmental issues and alternatives and shall reduce paperwork and the accumulation of extraneous background data. Statements shall be concise, clear, and to the point, and shall be supported by evidence that the agency has made the necessary environmental analyses. An environmental impact statement is more than a disclosure document. It shall be used by federal officials in conjunction with other relevant material to plan actions and make decisions. So, an EIS is to be short, sweet, and to the point. Notice that agencies are supposed to reduce paperwork and extraneous data. If you look through the CEQ regulations, it says that an EIS should be no more than 150 pages. But commonly today, due to the various lawsuits that have occurred, the average length of an EIS is close to 750 pages. Why is this? Probably because everything but the kitchen sink is thrown into an EIS in order to make them less likely to be attacked for being insufficient. So what kind of timing do we have? The CEQ spells out that an agency shall commence preparation of an EIS as close as possible to the time the agency is developing or is presented with a proposal so that preparation can be completed in time for the final statement to be included in any recommendation or report on the proposal. The statement shall be prepared early enough so that it can serve practically as an important contribution to the decision-making process and will not be used to rationalize or justify decisions already made. So an EIS is meant to be an integral part of the decision-making process. This isn't a rubber stamp document. How is an EIS organized? Well, the CEQ sets out the format in 40 CFR section 1502.10. A, cover sheet. B, summary. C, table of contents. Then we have purpose of a need for action, alternatives including the proposed action, and one of the alternatives is doing nothing, affected environment, environmental consequences, list of preparers, the list of agencies, organizations, and persons to whom copies of the statement were sent, an index, and any appendices. Considering how in-depth an EIS gets, the EPA has set up a website to help facilitate the environmental review process. If you're interested, check out NEPA Assist. So what's the recent status of NEPA? Well, we just celebrated 50 years of NEPA as of January 1st, 2022. Has NEPA been amended since it was originally signed into law? Yes, four times. In 1975, Congress gave the CEQ authority to reimburse for travel, both stateside and internationally. In 1982, Congress made changes to federal money and finance laws, which impacted all agencies, including CEQ and EPA, and their expenditures. In 2020, NEPA was changed to eliminate concepts of direct, indirect, and cumulative effects, instead focusing on effects that have a close causal relationship to a proposed action. And in April 2022, those 2020 changes were switched back, such that there has not been any changes to the main goals of NEPA. There are a couple of different ways we can think about recent NEPA updates. First, we can look at the courts to see if there are some important NEPA case decisions. Second, we can look to see what potential changes there are in how NEPA analyses are conducted or implemented. Finally, I'll briefly touch upon a January 2018 Supreme Court case that has some NEPA elements involved. So first, court cases. CEQ includes examples of NEPA case law at this website, but it doesn't look like it's been updated recently. A Google search for recent NEPA cases sends you to a Columbia Law School project looking at NEPA cases from a climate change relevance perspective. This list of cases, 340 at the time I prepared this lecture, appears to be current. Changes to the law in 2020. On January 9, 2020, President Trump directed the Council on Environmental Quality to update NEPA regulations, the economic benefits of improved infrastructure permitting. The president noted that after 50 years, NEPA's regulatory requirements have become unnecessarily complex and time-consuming and has delayed important infrastructure projects. According to CEQ data, completing the average environmental impact statement process takes 4.5 years. The delay is worse for highway projects in particular, with many statements taking over 6 years and some reviews taking decades. The 2020 regulation limited NEPA permit timing to be completed within 2 years and imposed a 150-day statute of limitations for contesting a NEPA permit. The previous statute of limitation was 6 years. The final 2020 regulation can be found at that CEQ website. But on April 20, 2022, the 2020 changes were essentially removed. From the CEQ website, the rule finalizes a narrow set of changes to generally restore regulatory provisions that were in effect for decades before the 2020 rule modified them for the first time. The final rule changes better align the NEPA regulations with CEQ and agency expertise, as well as NEPA's statutory goals and purpose of promoting sound decisions informed by science. Now let's look at the water wars. The Supreme Court heard arguments in Florida versus Georgia, 585 U.S., page number to be determined. It's docket number 142 ORIG, and it was decided June 27, 2018. It's a water wars case about water allocation and water flow into the Apalachicola River, downstream of Lake Lanier, the main water supply for Atlanta, Georgia. Florida petitioned the Supreme Court under original jurisdiction, meaning that the Supreme Court would hear the facts and make the decision, to make a decree for equitable distribution of water within the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River Basin, putting a cap on the amount of water taken by Georgia. The Supreme Court agreed to take on the case and assigned a special master to hear the arguments and issue a recommendation to the court. The special master said that Florida had not met the evidentiary burden of clear and convincing evidence. The Supreme Court held in a 5-4 split decision that the special master applied the wrong evidentiary standard and remanded the case back to the special master for further review. If you're interested in reading the actual decision, you can find it at oyez.org. For a more detailed review of all the proceedings, including all the filings, there is the SCOTUS blog, which also includes links to commentaries as well. Can you see NEPA issues threaded throughout this water rights case? Federal action needing to analyze potential environmental impacts of decisions. And then speaking for the trees. Not only does NEPA impact water, but trees as well. On December 13, 2018, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit handed down a decision against the U.S. Forest Service. Now, to give a small aside, you have probably heard about liberal judges and conservative judges in the news. Typically, these labels describe how judges interpret the laws that came before them. A conservative judge was one who looked at solely the words of the law as written and did not deviate from those words unless the law was in conflict with the U.S. Constitution. A liberal judge was one who looked at not only the words of the law as written, but also the spirit of the law, i.e. the reasoning behind the law. These descriptors are now more a political description. Liberal and conservative labels regarding interpretation, not political affiliation, can also be applied to the circuit courts of appeals. There are 11 numbered federal appellate courts, the Federal Circuit and the D.C. Circuit. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals covers the western edge of the U.S., Alaska, Arizona, California, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington states, and Guam and the Northern Mariana Island protectorates. and is known to be the most liberal circuit. The most conservative circuit is the Fourth Circuit, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. Though, let me tell you, the Fifth Circuit, which covers Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, is giving the Fourth Circuit a run for their money. So a three-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit quoted Dr. Seuss's The Lorax in striking down a U.S. Forest Service permit to build a natural gas pipeline across two national forests and the Appalachian Trail. They state, "We trust the United States Forest Service to speak for the trees have no tongues." Dr. Seuss, The Lorax. A thorough review of the record leads to the necessary conclusion that the Forest Service abdicated its responsibility to preserve national forest resources. This is from Cowpasture River Preservation Association et al. Versus the U.S. Forest Service. So that was the feds. What about language at the state level? To find the Florida Constitution and the statutes, I send you to the Florida Legislature. So the Florida Constitution, Article 2, Section 7, covers natural resources and scenic beauty. It shall be the policy of the state to conserve and protect its natural resources and scenic beauty. Adequate provision shall be made by the law for the abatement of air and water pollution and of excessive and unnecessary noise for the conservation and protection of natural resources. It goes on to also address the Everglades agricultural area. So what does this say in English? The Florida Constitution is very specific about protecting Florida's natural resources and scenic beauty. It also spells out who will be responsible for paying for water pollution in areas surrounding the Everglades. Now, the Florida statute, section 403.073, I'll let you read that on your own. In English, it says, this statute tells all political entities of Florida that not only is the state responsible for preventing pollution, but each individual political subdivision is responsible for preventing pollution within their individual bailiwicks, areas of authority. So all counties, cities, towns, regional agencies like the South Florida Water Management District, and all universities and state colleges are responsible for abating and preventing pollution on the properties they are in charge of. Florida Statute, Section 403.074, you may now pause to read. But in English, it says, the state has promised to give technical assistance to business, industry, agricultural, and state and local governments to help set up programs to reduce pollution emissions, as well as eliminating pollution emissions. If a state employee of these programs learns a business's proprietary information, that information shall be held confidential and not subject to disclosure under sunshine laws. And then ecosystem management. Florida has some interesting legislation that directly deals with ecosystem management. If you're interested in the precise statutory language, then take a look at Florida statute sections 403.075 through 403.0752. Our next class, we will look at the Endangered Species Act. And here's a whooping crane. In 1941, there were only 15 whooping cranes left in the continental United States.